welcome to OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
OEG Voices.
A podcast bringing to you the voices and ideas of open educators from around the world.
OEG Voices is produced by Open Education Global,
a member-based non-profit organization
supporting the development and use of open education globally.
Learn more about us at oeglobal.org.
There's much to take in at a global level.
We hope to bring you closer to how open education is working.
By hearing the stories of practitioners
told in their own voices.
Each episode introduces you to a global open educator.
We invite you to later engage in conversation with them
in our OEG Connect community.
Yes, it is time for another episode of the OEG Voices podcast. And I'm your host from Open Education Global, Alan Levine. And I'm pleased always to be joined by my colleague and the ringmaster for the Open Education Awards for Excellence, Marcella Morales. So welcome, Marcella. And we're heading into the nominations for this year's awards. How are things looking so far?
Yes. So first of all, thank you. Thank you for having me in this call. Super excited to be part of this conversation. And yes, we have nominations running right now, and they're looking great. I have to say that every year we say we cannot top these year's winners. And then new candidates come and new submissions are shared. And I can tell you that it's going to be another very exciting year. So we are really looking forward to that and excited to have a conversation with our current award winners. So very excited to be here. Thank you.
While these nominations are open, we're still, of course, there's so many award winners that it takes a while to talk to everybody. And so we have a pair of winners, and we kind of find these pairings are kind of interesting to have the conversation, to have overlap and intersections. And the connection here was really easy to make because both of these are projects from the same institution, the Open University, where, of course, Open is in its name. And so, you know, although these were awarded in the fall of 2021, this also gives us a chance maybe to look back on that time and see where these projects have gone. So enough introduction, Alan. Let's welcome to the studio our guest, Petrina Law, who's representing the Award for Open Resilience, giving to Open Learn's response to the pandemic. And also Andy Lane, who's going to tell us about the TIDE project, received an award in the Open Collaboration category. And we just really hope to learn more about Petrina and Andy and these projects that they did. So Petrina, can you tell us where in the world you are today and maybe tell us about your role with Open Learn and maybe how did you get into open education in the first place? So I front load these questions with a lot. So say what you want.
That's okay. Well, I'm in the UK. I'm in a county called Buckinghamshire. It's midsummer. It's a lovely day. I've worked at the Open University for over 20 years. And for the last 9 years, I've worked in open educational resources. And prior to that, I was working for the Institute of Educational Technology in the Open University, which was looking at, basically new developments in educational technology. And Open Educational Resources as a research entity and project entity sat within that group. And I became more and more interested in it and became particularly interested in the Open Learn project, which Andy was one of the founding members of that original project. Open Learn is a platform that hosts open educational resources, as you probably know, and became, like many online providers of educational content, sort of the user base went through the roof during the pandemic. So I'm very proud to be head of Open Learn and managing that team, looking at the future and how we move the platform on. It's stayed the course of time, despite the fact that its raison d'etre is social mission. We're very much proud of the fact that the university supports us to do open educational resources. We get a lot of love for that, and people would want to work with us. So I'm in a very lucky position of having staff who are keen to contribute to the platform and also a fantastic university of academics who want to write and work with us. So I'm in a very lucky position that we have a keen set of people who want to work and develop content for Open Learn. So yes, that's a bit of a summary of where we're at now. In terms of just to get an idea of scale, we had 22 million visits to Open Learn last year. So it's a big deal for us. And in the pandemic, something like 18 million people used our our platforms. That was a big hike for us. We went, our numbers doubled in a day from when we went into lockdown. So it was a really big deal. We scrabbled to do as much research as possible to find out why they were all there and what they were doing. But the impact was tremendous on us as individuals, but also on the learners themselves.
Right. And we want to like hear much more about this and how you handled this incredible challenge. And many of those visits in there, I count for a few of those. So thank you for everything that, that Open Learn does. And so I'm going to give Andy, of course, a chance to say hello. And I think related to the project you're going to talk about, we might say, and let me see if I get the pronunciation, is it Mingalaba? Is that the
Mingalaba.
Okay.
Mingalaba.
Okay.
That's sort of hello in Burmese.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Thai project was quite an interesting one, which I'll just come back to. I just sort of backtrack and say I'm now the Emeritus Professor of Environmental Systems at the Open University. I retired early this year after 38 years working for the Open University, so I've still got a role. And so I've been involved in open education in one form or another ever since then. But as Petrina said, I was the founding director for Open Learn, or the Open Content Initiative project. That it was initially funded in 2006 and 2008 by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. So that's where university, Open University, really got started on these things. And it's always been great to see since I left being directly involved in Open Learn in 2009, how it's gone on from strength to strength under the leadership of many others, including Petrina. But I also just mentioned, of course, Open Learn has got two identities. There's Open Learn, which is the big one, which we out there for the public, and Open University's own content is. But there's also what we now call Open Learn Create, the sort of sister platform where it's possible for other people and projects to be able to create their own open education resources and do things with it. I mentioned that because it's important to the TIDE projects. Coming back to the TIDE project, this was a project funded under the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office. So it's sort of UK aid funding. And it was part of a program which was about supporting higher education and trying to develop higher education elsewhere. And so the TIDE is a particular project which the Open University was the lead, was to try and improve the distance education provision in Myanmar, or Burma, as some people may know it. Quite interestingly, Myanmar had about 60% of its higher education students going through its distance education system. That's about 600,000. So it's quite big. So it's quite a big entity in that sense compared to most countries, where even with the UK Open University, it only has a small proportion of even the 170,000 students, is only a small proportion of the 2.5 million or whatever there are in UK higher education. So it's quite interesting. But of course, Myanmar has gone through a long period of being under military rule. Unfortunately, as I come back to, it's gone back to that. But there was this opening up, and there's this desire to try and improve things. And so what we were doing, we had a sort of twofold thing. We were both working on improving the and helping them in terms of their distance education provision, trying to get them to modernize and update it, and open education resources, and using both Open Learn and Open Learn Create was a key factor in that. The other element of it was we had a subject focus on the environment, environmental management, environmental science. And that's particularly where our sort of partner UK universities from Oxford and Manchester were involved. And so this was a sort of collaboration between the three UK universities, Open University in the lead. And then we were working closely with three Myanmar-based universities as well. So there was collaboration and partnership built into the project. And so we were meant to run for 4 years, but unfortunately the military coup in early 21 stopped it short about 6 months before the end.
Wow. Well, there's so much to talk about. Both of these projects involve an impressive amount of coordination, and we'd love to hear your secrets of how you get things done. So I maybe come back to Petrina, because obviously you're already very busy with Open Learn. And so when things came to a sudden change in March of 2020, what was the ask that came to you? Like what was said and said, we need you to do X? And how did you start doing that?
Well, first and foremost was we needed IT to give us some more servers, and they did, because the sheer volume of traffic was just overwhelming, and IT really rose to the challenge, and suddenly we were top of the list for more servers. It was an incredible thing, really. So that was the first ask, was make sure the platform is robust, and it did remain robust, actually. And then the other requests came in, which was initially about curating content for particular groups who needed it, and then the request to make new content for people who, particular groups who needed it. So some of that curation exercise was really based around employability. People were losing their jobs, they were becoming furloughed, they wanted to signal that they were upskilling in another area. And some of the stories that we got heard from our learners were sort of heartbreaking in some ways. Their businesses had clearly were failing and they had ended. They had to find a new reason to do something. And so our job was to really think about what we were delivering on the platform from an employability perspective and to align that with people's needs. And from the UK perspective, that came very much as specific requests for the four nations of the UK. So that was Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England. Because they have slightly different approaches to how they manage work and workforce and training. And also the different regions of the UK have different employment needs as well. So we worked closely with government colleagues to create content, to create new content that were specific to those people's needs. Then as a kind of overarching UK response, it was very much about the fact that the NHS, the National Health Service, we hear this, so the free health service that we have in the UK, had a shortage of workers. And so there was a big drive to say, how do we get people back into the NHS? Those people who had retired needed reskilling and upskilling. So there was a drive to make sure we had resources online for NHS workers and those who have been out of the system for a while. So that was a really big effort with our colleagues who work in healthcare in the university. And that was a combination of new content and existing. So that was a big drive. Then there was a big drive to get people to think about voluntary work. Again, the government were asking us to volunteer for a range of different things. So suddenly our voluntary courses and advice pages became very, very popular. So that was another set of requirement to update to make sure people understood what voluntary sector working meant to them. Then there was the kind of sort of meta challenge of explaining to people how you work with your CV. What does a digital badge mean to you? How can an Open University certificate support your way? And so we had a lot to explain about the value of non-formal learning to people, because obviously our content doesn't carry any credit. So there was all of that as well. So yes, it came from all directions all at once. Our workforce were taken off campus immediately, obviously, just like everybody else. People were trying to work from home with dogs and cats and children and homeschool whilst managing a workload that frankly went through the roof. But we have a very strong team, and I'm very lucky for that reason that everyone did all come together and produce the things that they were being asked to do. There was very little desire to say no to anybody in that regard. Another strong piece that came out for us was about writing and curating new content on mental health support. So that was, again, a global thing. That's not a UK-specific thing, but very much thinking about how do we support people from the mental health perspective as well. In terms of our audience at that time, we had historically had a 50-50 UK global split on the platform. We saw during the pandemic sort of year 18 months of the sort of serious set of lockdowns that we went through, that actually our biggest audience was international. So that shifted to around about a 60-40 international UK split. And within that, a lot of people in India using our content as well, and the US. So we had this sort of surge of people looking at the platform from other parts of the world. So from an analytics perspective, it was really exciting, because, well, what are these people looking at? What do they want? Why are they different? And what do they need? And because everyone was affected by the pandemic in different ways. So we could see that different countries needed different things, and certain things were popular with other groups. And a lot of this is really focused our minds on how we might think in the future about translating more open learn content into other languages for people who need it the most, particularly our current refugee crisis, and how we might we work, you know, how might we serve those individuals in the future. So we the lessons that came out of it were are affecting how we think about our strategy now, very much valuing and putting more emphasis on our employability content. And really thinking about our global audience as well and what we need to do for them. It's all very well delivering English OER for people who can speak English, but what about the people that can't, that need it most? So yes, it was a game changer for us, I think, in a lot of ways as to how we deliver things. We also found as well that we had a tremendous number of people from all around the world declaring that they were educators, school teachers. Suddenly, how do I teach online? How do I do this? And we had a course that was doing pretty well. It was a Take Your Teaching Online, which was written by our colleagues who are very close to Open Educational Resources, actually. And suddenly that became one of our most popular courses. And we were really conscious then that we had a lot of educators using the site. So we did a lot of research with them to say, what is it you're looking for? How do you need to use our site? A lot of them were suddenly very interested in our videos. We have sort of 2,500 to 3,000 videos on YouTube and also on Open Learn. Suddenly videos were very important in teaching, but also teachers wanting to know how to teach online. That became a really big deal for us. So again, that was another ask to make sure we had all of that content updated and really ship shape. So yes, it's hard to sort of know when to stop talking about all the different groups that we were trying to serve, because it really did affect so many people in so many different ways. Many people really having a joyful experience of having the time to study when they haven't had any time to study. It did result in more people signing up to the Open University to take a degree because they had time. They had had that eureka moment of, oh my goodness, I can do this thing. And I'd always wanted to do this thing and I hadn't had the time to do it. So there was also the positives that came out of it for some people who were furloughed and then did have more time on their hands.
That's fascinating to hear about how the reach expanded so much. And I think you anticipated most of my questions, but that's really brilliant. I was just wondering, did you have to radically change your production process? Must have had to be much more compressed. And I'm thinking not only the sheer amount of work that you had to do, but also for your staff having to be not together and working remotely and managing. I mean, how did you coordinate and change up your operational side?
We just had to reprioritized. There were things that clearly were trumping other things on a sort of weekly basis. So yes, it was really a case of reprioritizing. Also, we're quite used to and have always been used to doing a lot of filming work. So of the courses on OpenLearn and the interactives that we produce as well, we rely on really good video to tell the stories. Particularly our educational interactives often have a story theme running through them, and we're able to use those videos that we make to illustrate particular concepts in other ways. We can send those videos out separately. They don't need to be part of the interactive. And they're really fabulous. Some of those interactives have won awards for the sort of storytelling and the kind of, if you like, the narrative that goes in them and the fact that you can sort of fictionalize something that actually you're teaching about. And suddenly we couldn't go out and do filming. You know, our videos suddenly became something that you did like this online, talking to other folk. Right. So we had to sort of rethink about how we were going to manage video production as well. So that was, and managed very well it was, but it's now we're getting back into the ability to be able to go back and do things on location, whereas everything had to be done online or the recording. But yes, I think really it was a case of reprioritization. But we didn't lack for people wanting to support the work. We were very lucky where we did have to jump. The academics we work with were brilliant.
Thank you. And we're going to come back because I have a lot more questions, and I'm sure Marcella does too. But Andy, let's talk about Myanmar. Like, what was your, did you have experience with Myanmar? And did you have to, how did you even start this major project and coordinate working with such a big team and doing it remotely, right?
Well, it was not remotely. It ended up being remote. In that sense, so it actually sort of dates back quite some time. So there have been particular people, especially in Manchester and Oxford, researchers and others who've been doing work and collaborating with academics in Myanmar universities for many years. So there's already some contacts there. Then, because as I was saying, when when the National League for Democracy became the sort of civilian part of the government back in about 2014, was it before that, they slowly started wanting to develop things up. So they were looking for investment from overseas. And because we have in the UK, we have the British Council who goes in there. The British Council is in the presence there. So the British Council can be a sort of brokerage between the country and UK higher education and other things around these things. And so there was a lot of discussions going on about how can higher education in Myanmar be supported generally, and particularly the distance education things. And so there have been a lot of discussions, and the Open University, because of the earliest Open University, we've throughout our history have been supporting the development and the initiation of other open universities around the world. We're part of a sort of club in that sense. So we've already been doing a lot of that work. So it just came about that there was this group of people and institutions that I mentioned who wanted to do something, and then the funding opportunity came up, this particular program. And so it was quite easy to put together the program, but of course we had to make a bid, and we were one of 172 bids put into this particular program, only seven of which were funded. So you know, there was a lot of competition for that. The key part of it was it was a very strong partnership. There were already connections and things going on to make it important and to be able to design what we needed to do, people with experience of doing this. And as I said earlier, it's quite a challenge here because the distance education system in Myanmar that existed was that there are two distance education universities, Yangon University of Distance Education in Lower Myanmar, and Mandalay University of Distance Education in Upper Myanmar. It's quite a big country and split up. And they produce the educational materials that students studied. The only educational materials they were producing were printed books and some filming and video broadcasts. It's all broadcast. They barely touched doing anything online. And equally, even with the type of teaching and pedagogy they're using in their printed materials is very didactic, and the assessment was just a sort of sit-down three-hour exam. It was very sort of rote learning and things like that. They weren't thinking about how to make the whole education experience more rewarding for the students and also be able to prepare them better for being good citizens and for getting employment. And so the people didn't value this distance education system. So we were trying to help the academics, both from the two distance education universities, but also from across the 40 arts and science universities who provided local tuition and support for the distance education students, being such a big place and things like that. So as a distance education student, you'd have your materials to study, but you'd also have a sort of 1 week where you'd be able to do some field work or laboratory work. But most of it was exam cramming, to be honest. So we had a lot to do to try to put it together. So we had a program of activities. We could get them to start studying online, so studying some of the courses on OpenLearn, how to teach online, you know, the one that Petrina mentioned, we used. We could also use OpenLearn Create, as I say, to take versions of things off OpenLearn and sometimes to translate them or to adapt them and get them to start working with these types of materials as well. But of course, to make that really effective, we couldn't do all that remotely. So the original plan, which we would, for the first half of the project we were able to do before COVID hit, is that there'd be all the different cohorts from the different universities were going to be going through 4 5-day residential schools. So we'd have get them all together at one place. There's about 100 academic staff at one go, and we'd give them intensive teaching about modern pedagogy, how to use technology, how to do things, trying to make it as practical as possible, but try to upskill them in that they're sort of teaching and doing these things. Alongside that, there was a lot of other work we were trying to do in terms of working with the university rectors to get them to think about the how they can reform the processes in their universities and how they can provide professional development. And we were also working with the Ministry of Education on some policy initiatives, including the potential establishment of a Myanmar Open University. So it was a long time. So those are the types of things we're doing. Of course, when COVID hit, we could no longer go out there and do these residential schools. It changed everything. And we had to change over immediately into providing online provision, reworking a lot of the things we did to online courses and to try to accelerate their experience of and acceptance of online teaching and learning, as well as obviously trying to get them to think about the open education resources, open licensing. And we even went as far as versioning the Creative Commons and translating the Creative Commons certificate in open licensing to be available for Myanmar. So we did a lot of work of reworking material, taking other material, trying to adapt it for its online provision. And so this was, it was a second best in some ways, obviously, to that intensive hands-on in-country stuff, which is really needed for people who are so new to this. You know, it's not just new to online learning. You know, when we first went there into 2017 and restarted in 2018, some of the universities had barely got Wi-Fi. You know, it was broadband. You know, it was like that. You know, most people had a phone, smartphone, but that's it. They didn't have a laptop, you know, a thing. So we had to think about how we do this. Things were all improving all the time. But of course, all this was then brought to an end by the military coup in February 2021. And that just stopped us being able to do anything. Well, actually, the Foreign Commonwealth Development Office came to us and saying, you're going to have to stop. But they did allow us 3 months in which to try to draw together a lot of the material we've been producing and develop some new material in that time to create a legacy set of materials that, based on everything we've done, which now house an Open Learn Create, which are still there and can be accessed and used by people in Myanmar and elsewhere. So we're hopeful if things change in Myanmar, the situation were to change, there'll be the basis of material and the people we were able to provide some training and professional development with, maybe have to pick it all up again and get started. But, you know, it's very unfortunate that, you know, we had this great collaboration and partnership working with the UK universities and the Myanmar universities, creating material, versioning it, trying to adapt it for them. And it's a sort of great legacy there. It's just disappointing to say that the situation in Myanmar means that it's not being used for that sort of longer term benefit, which we were hoping for.
Wow. I mean, pandemic is huge enough, but to deal with the shifting change and to have everything unplugged. So I can't even imagine what it took to sort of keep things going and shuffle and change. And so that's very fortunate that they at least provided that window for yeah. the legacy part. And I love this like thread that you know, Open Learn and the Create platform kind of weaves across the work that both you do, which says a lot about the idea behind it. I'm just, you know, there's so many, I'd love to hear stories maybe from each of you. Petrina, like you hinted at some stories that you heard from students, but I'm also curious, were there any courses that maybe surprised you for being popular or of interest, or maybe that you didn't think that you'd have to develop in certain areas? What are some standout course and maybe experience memories?
Yes, I think probably it was the Take Your Teaching Online, which did surprise us, and that really kind of shone a light on the fact that we had so many teachers working. And we had comments from teachers across Africa saying, you know, I value these materials. So we had a real global perspective on what people were doing and what they wanted. I've got a quote here from an African teacher in Gabon who says that OpenLearn has given me varied ways of supporting my students in times of crisis and how to build my capacity in the use of internet materials for teaching students. And we published that on our website, actually, and it was useful to see that so many people around the world were using OpenLearn for teaching purposes, which had been part of its original raison d'etre. It was expected when OpenLearn was first started as a project that around over 50% of the audience would, of course, be people reusing our content for teaching. And actually, it became something slightly different. And it was interesting to see that during the pandemic, it did sort of come home, if you like, that actually a significant number of people were using the website to support teaching. And I think that's been a huge change. Obviously, it's prompted other educational institutions to think about how they deliver lessons, et cetera, going forward. It's been a massive change. So I think that for us was a big deal. It also exposed for me how differently the four nations in the UK work in terms of skills and employability and finances and all the rest of it. So that was having to serve slightly different sets of legislation was interesting as well. You think UK is not very big, but oh my goodness, there's a difference in the way that some of the legal system works for the different nations. And I think as well, from my perspective, I ran a survey during the end of 2020 to see what learners were saying about us, because I wanted to get that kind of qualitative insight, if you like. Tens of thousands of responses to that survey, but that's the stuff I love. And for us, it was the little stories that came through that reminded us about the subjects that were particularly interesting and important. And they were the sort of things that you don't expect to come out of a university curriculum that are often very popular on OpenLearn. So, for example, we have a badge course called Understanding Autism. And that just, it was already popular, but that became really very, very popular, as opposed to your kind of normal understanding psychology, basic maths and all the rest of it. But yes, it became a thing. It became a thing on Facebook. It had a bit of a kind of viral moment on Facebook there. But that just appealed to so many different people. And one of the quotes I have here from someone who used this course and earned the badge is this, which is, "I'm a carer for an autistic 25-year-old recently diagnosed. I wanted to help understand her and help her understand herself too. You may have saved her life. I feel empowered to support people more confidently through my work. Before COVID, I didn't have the time to do a course in this depth. This course is amazing, and I get brownie points at the end with a digital badge." So you've kind of got that sense for us as well. And that's sort of, we're reminded that we're not just a university output with kind of bog standard pieces of the curriculum going out that you would expect from your standard undergraduate degrees. We've got some really interesting research that's woven into our curriculum, and also before it gets into the curriculum as well, we're able to publish it on OpenLearn. And I think subjects like autism, ADHD and other mental health issues suddenly became very popular on the site, and it reminded us actually from a commissioning perspective, it's important to think slightly differently about what's popular, and just to remind people that science degrees it's not all about test tubes and graphs. You know, there's much more to it, understanding the human mind and a whole variety of other things. And so I think those are the key stories for me that came out about commissioning. Certainly looking to the future, and this is something that Andy was talking about with regard to people might have a mobile phone, but they don't necessarily have a desktop computer. We could quite clearly see from our data that those who were in the low socioeconomic groups with the least access to education were using mobile phones to access the site. And actually, our mobile phone experience is adequate, but it could be better. And I think we're realizing now that actually, if we're going to meet the low socioeconomic group, and the globally speaking as well, who are much, much bigger users of smartphones for learning, we need to improve our mobile experience and make that a little bit more compatible to their needs too.
That's really key. Thank you. I want to ask Andy some more about, because when you look at the diagram of the parts of the TIDE project, it's much more than just doing courses. And so how did that design evolve to include things like change management and the academic and technical perspectives? And so it's a pretty complex bit, but it seems to be quite different from your usual project where you're trying to reach a large audience like you were doing.
Well, it is a big scale project, but the university has been involved in many big scale projects, both internally, nationally and internationally. one of the things with an international project like this, and the Sphere program under which it came, is you had to write something called a theory of change. You may know about that. You had to set this out clearly in terms of all the activities you're going to do and what the changes will be at different levels and things like that. So one of the other key elements of this is understanding a development intervention of this scale. If you're trying to change something, you've got to try to make changes in as many parts of the system at the same time. So that's why we had that strand, which was working with the university staff and their professional development. There's that element about the sort of change management of the university rectors and the sort of universities as institutions, because it'd be no good training the academics and others in these new skills if rectors just say, "Why are you doing that? What's the bottom? You know, I'm not interested in that. You know, do this, that, the other." You've got to make sure that the two things line up. But of course, in this case of Myanmar and these universities, they're all under the control of the Ministry of Education, a very centralized things. But one of the things at that stage they wanted to do was to decentralize things and to give greater autonomy to the different universities. So again, we need to support them in that autonomy, but we also had to work with the Ministry of Education again in terms of sort of policies and try to advise them on about the ways they can do to set up structures and processes which is going to support the universities and the rectors, and then the rectors in the universities can then support their staff. So you really do have to try to work at all those different levels if you're going to truly get some transformation and change across the system. Otherwise, if you just fiddle about at one part of it, you don't know if you're going to get traction in other parts of the system. So it's critical. And we were very fortunate in that we had that enormous buy-in from everybody. So in fact, the Minister of Education himself actually came to at least three of the residential schools we put on to open them and to say things to the participants there. You know, it's not just the rectors or things like this. The Minister of Education and his Deputy Director General for Higher Education, big thing. So everybody saw it as being a big deal. That in itself obviously caused some anxious issues for us, because there so much was expected of us. We were almost expected to do absolutely everything. But I think we still kept within the bounds of what we did, but did have an enormous impact. And so we know that this is a favoured project from Minister of Education, that the rectors were all buying into it, that the staff really liked it as well. And so I think that is equally important. You need to, I think this is the thing with all open and distance education and things like that. Those on the receiving end have really got to want it. You know, yeah. With Open Learn, they're going out, they're going and find it because they want it. I want something. And so going in a development project like this, you've got to be sure that the participants really want to do it. They want to change. They want to develop, and they did. But interestingly, this is an anecdote about this. You know, from the Open University, University of Manchester, and Oxford University, over the lifetime of the project, there's about 50 staff from those different universities, from probably about 15 different countries, actually were involved and went out to Myanmar at various stages. And almost to a person, they were just blown away by the attitude, the desires of the staff out there in Myanmar. For many, they just felt this is one of the most important projects they've ever been involved in. And many of them have been working in international development projects and working in different countries for many years. I think it is when you get everything aligned and everything right and everything working, then it really is powerful. And so I think that's why it's so immensely sad that it all got cut short and not allowed to continue in the way that we'd set it off.
Right. Talk about the change that you had to manage in action. So Yeah, thank you for that. Marcella, I'm hogging the microphone. Is there anything you want to ask our guests?
You're doing great. Loving the questions, loving the... It's really fascinating to listen to both of you, because I've been following your work ever since I started in open education a little bit more than 10 years ago. So I'm really wondering, from both of you that have been early supporters of open education, you have done so much in your journey involved with openness. I wonder, what is the one thing that has surprised you of where the open education movement is now? When I started like in 2008, but I know that your journey has been begun before that. Is there something that we're doing now that you didn't expect the open education movement to do and to be at this point in time?
I suppose the one thing which has really come out strongly over the years is the working with, when I say non-traditional groups. So traditionally for the Open University and our students and things, they sign up to us, we're dealing with students. Yes, many of them are in employment, so there are their employers there. But I think that the whole idea of open education resources and their use by all types of organisations, it's not just employers, there's non-governmental organisations, charities and others, have all picked up on the importance and sort of value there can be for online learning and open learning. And we've ended up doing over the years many different projects, and you know, TIDE is an example, but there's been other projects I've been involved in where we've created online courses or educational resources that sit on Open Learn Create out of these projects, which are in unusual topics and subjects, but they're relevant to that community, to that organisation and those things. So I think it's getting out of what you might call the very sort of traditional education stroke higher education sort of field of activity, which I think has been one of the things which I think has been more surprising to me.
I think for me, there's, you know, initially when the OER movement started and various of the projects and platforms got funding, that was a big impetus to get work going. And over the years, obviously that funding from the big philanthropists has now ended largely. And so the big providers of OER have got to show how they will survive and therefore go down a particular route to sustain themselves, if you like. And you see, I see that obviously in several ways that have become quite steady. We've got University of the People and Sailor and various people just sort of honing in on a particular set of qualifications and a particular need that they can serve using open educational resources. And we're very happy to contribute to those with our own OER because we're all Creative Commons. So, I think that there's been a kind of, instead of just going, here, it's all for free, just come and get it, you can pick something from over there or over here, people have had to find a reason and show a business model, if you like. So for me, I think, whilst that's not necessarily new news, I think from the Open Learn's perspective, we can associate that business model with recruiting students into the Open University that has no barriers to entry. So that's good for us. But I think as well, for me, the thing that I would like to see that I think we're missing a trick with is the use of digital badges and open educational resources, because we still don't charge for anything. And I think digital badges and open educational resources are still separate. And I think the digital badging movement with its open badge infrastructure underpinning it could be a really happy marriage. We can see that they're immensely popular, digital badges on Open Learn. They represent something in between non-formal learning and accredited learning. They give some extra value. And so for me, from my sort of small sort of worldview, if you like, I think the thing that's changed for us is that acknowledgement that you can get real value from OER if you haven't paid for it and it's not for a formal qualification. There's still something in between that, in that other space, that says with digital badges and digital metadata, I can still do something that will align me to a different career. So yes, I would say that's not new for us, but something that I think is evolving and I would like to see more of with other OER providers.
We do hear you, and the next round of awards are going to be issued digital badges, and I'm talking to Marcella. I think we should retroactively make sure we give you more than just a picture of the award badge. And so I'm glad you brought that up, because I know there's a lot of interest in it, and then people have moved on to some other things. So I'm glad to hear that's a big motivation, and it's meaningful for your learners to come to Open Learn. I may be curious, we talked about a lot of changes that have come your way. What's the thing that keeps you going and motivated in all this work? Like when you wake up in the morning and you're looking at all the things you have to do, what gives you energy?
I think it's because I work with a very excited and interested SIT4 of team, most of whom are younger than me, and they have fresher minds, and we're never short of ideas. And that's the thing, it's managing all the kind of new ideas and innovation and wishing that we had like the endless budget to deliver them all. So for me, what gets me up in the morning, at the moment, it's the idea that we're going to be working towards translating OER into languages needed by ostensibly refugees and people in the poorest countries in the world, trying to find a funder for that, working with our International Development Office to do that. That's really exciting for me. So that at the moment is motivating me. And then really kind of on the ground, it's looking at the new commissions that have come in for our upcoming financial year, some of the content that people are thinking about to provide online for people who can't afford to study but will be free, is serving the need for the green economy to get off the ground. There's many jobs that can't be filled because people don't have the qualifications for the green economy. So it's thinking about commissioning for the green economy. It's also commissioning content courses, etc., in Black leadership. And so some of these things that come from the faculties, and you know, it's a bit push from us and pull from them and vice versa. But actually, I think that gets me up in the morning as well. When I look at some of these new ideas coming through, I think, oh, that's just fantastic. I can't wait to see, you know, who's going to be interested in that. And I'm just be so proud to promote that. The other thing at the moment that's making me excited is that we are going to be on TikTok with Open Learn shortly, and later on this year, Spotify with Learning. So not as a social media channel as such, but jumping into that whole hashtag Learn on TikTok. And I think that's something like 13 billion people have looked at Learn on TikTok now, and sort of trying to reach different age groups with OER with just short form Learn. And we've got quite a robust audience on YouTube, but sort of looking at other channels, because we spread our OER over a variety of different places, not just the Open Learn platform. So yes, I would say at the moment those are the things that are making me quite excited, translation and all of those sort of key projects at the moment.
Do you use TikTok?
Do I use TikTok? I have to.
I don't.
My 12-year-old uses TikTok, so I have an interest in making sure I know what he's looking at. So personally, it doesn't float my boat, but it does for a lot of people. And
Oh, no, it's excellent to hear. And seriously, like that it says a lot about what Open Learn does to really keep moving things forward. And so I think, Marcella, we should just give them another award right now, but we'll see how the process comes through. Andy, what makes you
done?
What drives you to keep on with this work?
Well, it is providing education opportunity. It's as simple as that. It's providing education opportunity to as many people as possible. I mean, the Open University as a whole, and sort of worked there over 38 years, it's just that it provides more opportunities for a wider set of people, and a set of people who may not traditionally be able to get access to higher education or education in other ways. So open education resources and Open Learn and Open Learn Create are just other means in which to sort of take or to provide those learning opportunities, education opportunities for many more people, however they want to do it. And I think it's great that other people are use the material and rip off the material and do other things. It's fascinating, I think, where you get organisations do it and you don't know it all. There's work in for instance, we've had some schemes in the UK, say in Wales and Scotland, for what they call Open Learn Champions, where you get very disadvantaged people or people with learning difficulties will come to a community centre, and there'll be somebody there who will help them to actually use a computer, which may be challenging for them, but also to sort of go on to Open Learn or something like that. It's a simple material, just say, you know, yes, you can learn, you can do this, you know, because for so many people is not only can they access it, there's this always overriding magic. Can I do this? I'm not good enough. I failed at school. I can't learn. I can't do this. But in the Open University in general, it's shown that people, whatever their starting place is, if you can provide those enough of those opportunities and enough of that support, then they can learn something, they can help themselves, they can develop. That's what sort of gets me up in terms of doing all this, because I think, you know, the more opportunities we can provide to more people to be able to learn, to for them to be able to achieve some learning goals, some learning achievement in whatever form they want it to be, then, you know, I think that's a great success.
Well, I'm refreshed and energized, and I really appreciate Petrina and Andy that you've taken this time to talk to us about your work and everything behind it. We could talk for hours, but I want to thank anybody listening and everybody listening for this episode of OEG Voices. This is a podcast we're doing here at Open Education Global to bring you people like Petrina and Andy and get to know them and their work. And so we'll have some featured open license music in the background. It's a track I picked called The Mage, which is kind of upbeat and energetic and really fits what we did here. And it's by an artist named Ketsa, found in the Free Music Archive. It's licensed Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives. And so you'll find this episode at our voices, voices.oeglobal.org. And we hope that you might want to follow up in some conversations with our guest at our OEG Connect community. And we have a whole wave of award winners to bring on and a few other guests on our future schedule. And just want to thank you both for taking this time to join us.
Thank you for having us. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.